Americans want action on global warming. A new poll finds that a majority want politicians and companies to take steps to combat climate change and promote clean energy. We'll talk about it. And Mayim Bialik joins us. You may know her as Blossom or Amy Fowler from The Big Bang Theory. We'll talk to her about her career and why she left the real world geeks in academia for those on The Big Bang. Plus a vaccine that might one day reverse the effects of a cocaine overdose in humans. We'll talk to the scientist who developed the potential antidote about how it works and its ability to save lives, and why he says drug companies have little interest in developing treatments for drug addiction. It's all coming up after this break, so stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Stroke, kidney failure, seizures are some of the devastating effects of a cocaine overdose that kill thousands of people each year. But new research has created hope that a cocaine overdose antidote may soon be available for doctors who administer in emergency situations. In a study published in the American Chemical Society journal Molecular Pharmaceuticals, researchers say they have developed an injectable solution that reverses the effects of a lethal dose of cocaine. At least it does so now in mice. Dr. Kim Janda was a co-author of the study and has worked on vaccines for heroin, meth, and even nicotine. He's professor in the Department of Chemistry, Immunology, and Microbial Science at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, and he joins us from there. Welcome to Science Friday. Hello, Dr. Janda. Are you there? No? Having trouble hearing us? Dr. Janda, can you hear us?
Hello?
Hello there.
I can't hear the show, but I can hear you.
Oh, all right. We're going to have to work out our technical difficulties. Maybe we can push a button and make something happen so that Dr. Janda can hear us.
Or just press go.
Or press go.
I'm hearing
Dr. Janda,
yeah,
can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, that's better. I love live radio. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Tell us about this vaccine. This is a potential antidote. Are you saying that if in mice, when the mice had a cocaine overdose, you were able to reverse the effects of it?
Yes, that's correct. Basically, when they were given a lethal dose, we were able to use a preformed antibody and inject it, and basically the mice didn't die from the overdose. They all lived.
What was working there? How does it work?
Basically, it seeks out cocaine very quickly, sequesters it, and removes it from the body.
Mm-hmm. And is this the same kind of thing that might be possible in humans?
Well, that's what we're working towards. The antibody that we prepared is what's known as a human monoclonal antibody versus a mouse monoclonal antibody. So we're gearing everything towards trying to move into clinical trials.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the next steps here?
The next steps would be able to make it efficiently in large quantity and then test it out in some type of human trial.
Is it possible you might be able to create a vaccine that's used beforehand?
Well, we and other groups have looked at what's called an active vaccine for treating cocaine addiction, but the differences between that and what we're using, what's called a passive vaccine for overdose, is that the active vaccines take weeks to get on board, and they'd never reach what's called an antibody titer that would be high enough to protect from a cocaine overdose. So this is in the same genre, but a little bit different venue how we're setting this up.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you have been looking at vaccines for addiction, have you not?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Tell us about that search and what the difficulties are in that.
Well, we've been looking at vaccines for cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, nicotine addiction for well over 25 years. And, many years ago, we used to think treating one addiction, one drug addiction is similar to treating another. It's not. And so we've found the path to be quite difficult at times, depending on the particular drug we're working at with.
So they all have different pathways of working, and
well, they all have different they work differently, you know, in terms of the receptors they hit, in terms of how they're metabolized in our body and how they interact with our body's tissue. So each one's a very different animal in trying to attack.
Is this something that a drug company would be interested in developing if you found some research or did some of the basic research?
I really wish it would, but I think a lot of big drug companies don't feel that drug addicts are a great investment. So they've kind of shied away from looking at therapies for addiction. I wish they would get more involved, that's for sure.
Well, what about something for an overdose? You don't have to be a drug addict to have an overdose.
That's for sure. And what we really think this overdose, and if it would be moved forward with a company, would be packaged as a shot to have on hands-on, you know, with ambulance or ER clinics for you know, life or death situations.
Doesn't it raise some ethical concerns about having an antidote?
I don't think an antidote raises the ethical concerns. The ethical concerns would be more raised with the what's known as the active vaccine, which basically requires multiple injections, and you'd have circulating antibodies for life in that potential individual. So, you know, one could be potentially marked that you had that vaccine. The antidote vaccine we're developing now would be eliminated in the body within a matter of days.
Mm-hmm. So it is possible you could create sort of a prophylactic vaccine.
It's possible, but for the active vaccines, yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of research that's going on in this field?
It's sparse. There's some groups that have been working on this for a number of years, but like I said, it's the research requires a lot of different initiatives, so it's not something that a group who's just doing chemistry or immunology can do. You have to kind of meld together chemistry, immunology, and neuropharmacology to kind of look at this overall process.
And is there a great interest? You say there might be interest if you can develop this, and for people, the drug companies, because it's given later, might be interested in this, as opposed to giving, as you say, prophylactics to drug addicts.
Well, I think both are quite appealing. I think for, you know, an immediate situation, the antidote is obviously much more appealing. But, you know, in terms of long term maintenance and abstinence for possibly treating cocaine addicts, I think the active vaccine mm-hmm. would be the best way to go.
What about other habit forming drugs or dangerous drugs? Does this open the pathway for antidotes for them also?
Sure. I think one can look at this for heroin and other drugs like that, maybe methamphetamine. I think that looking at this overall methodology would be useful for those types of drugs also. Even and possibly like things like oxycodone.
Oxycodone, yeah. You could possibly do it with that.
I see no reason why not.
And as far as human clinical trials, when might they start?
Well, I think if we can, like I said, make it more efficiently in large quantities, then hopefully we can see someone step up the plate who want to partner with us and move this forward.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Okay, thank you for having me on.
Dr. Kim Janda is the co-author of the study, the American Chemical Society Journal Molecular Pharmaceuticals, about a potential... well, treatment for overdoses of cocaine and who knows what other kinds of drugs. He's a professor at the Department of Chemistry, Immunology, and Microbial Science at the Scripps Research Institute. Depending on how old you are, you may know my next guest as the girl who played the young Bette Midler in Beaches, or as the star of the 90s sitcom Blossom, or as Amy Farrah Fowler, Sheldon Cooper's sort of girlfriend on The Big Bang Theory, or maybe you know her as all three, but you might not know that actor Mayim Bialik also has a PhD in neuroscience. So why trade the world of real science geeks and academia for the geeks on The Big Bang Theory? She's here to tell us. Mayim Bialik is an actor and also the author of a new book, Beyond the Sling, A Real-Life Guide to Raising Confident, Loving Children the Attachment Parenting Way. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. What made you decide to switch from the world of real science to science on TV?
I don't know that there's an easy, quick answer, but I'll do my best. My husband and I had our first son when we were both in graduate school at UCLA, and honestly, we kind of fell in love with being with our kids, and in particular really found a lot of value, both because I was studying the hormones of human attachment and because it made a lot of sense to us intuitively. We wanted me to be with our kids more than that kind of science career might have allowed for. You know, the joke is that I figured I'll start auditioning here and there, and actors never work, so I'll be with my kids a ton. And I guess it was true until it wasn't. And when our younger son was almost two, I auditioned for Big Bang Theory, but even still, I wasn't made a regular till kind of end of last season, and a sitcom schedule happens to be very friendly, but at least in those early months and years of nursing and sleeping and all that stuff, I was absolutely able to be home with them, and I couldn't have done that the same way had I stayed in academia.
I hear you. 1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk with Mayim. And also our tweet. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Now, tell us behind the scenes, how close is she to how you really were as a scientist, the character you play?
Well, I mean, I'm still a scientist, you know. I think once a scientist, always a scientist. So the way I approach the world in a lot of ways is very similar to Amy. You know, I'd like to think I'm a little more socially skilled than Amy, but really just by a fraction of a hair. You know, obviously our characters are all meant to entertain, and so there's a lot of aspects of comedy and of things we say that are really done for the purposes of the audience. But I think in terms of the way she approaches, you know, her science craft, I'd like to think I had a lot of that same focus and dedication, which honestly many do, and especially females, you know, trying to make a name in a pretty much male-dominated field. I think you get a specific kind of personality, for sure.
Some people have been critical of it. I mean, I love the show, and I've actually been on the show once, talking to Sheldon. But some people have been critical of it, saying, you know, it's too stereotyped. How do you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that also from kind of the feminist side, you know, in terms of the female characters. I like to think that at least my character is one of Chuck Lorre's, I think, finest examples of a complicated female that he has shown. But, you know, we are there to entertain. That is ultimately what we do. And so stereotypes are entertaining. They have been for all of entertainment history. I know people like all of those characters and then some. And to me, the fact that we're showing a slice of life of people who kind of live the way the rest of us live, meaning not the Beverly Hills 90210 or the Friends kind of social structure. These are people who love science fiction, they love comic books, they view the world as scientists, and no one is psychoanalyzing them about it. This is a group of people who are how the rest of us live.
Terrific. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Mayim Bialik, who's also an actor on The Big Bang Theory, also author of Beyond the Sling, A Real-Life Guide to Raising Confident, Loving Children, The Attachment Parenting Way. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Mayim Bialik, who is one of the stars on The Big Bang Theory. She plays Amy Farrah Fowler. I guess Mayim sort of Sheldon's girlfriend. Has that ever been really defined, what's going on there?
Well, I was his friend who was a girl who was not his girlfriend for a while, and we now have a relationship agreement. So, you know, depending on which side of the shamey you fall on, yes or no.
So they didn't pick you as an actress because you were a biologist, a neurobiologist?
No. The industry is far more fickle and superficial than that.
But did they give you the choice of what the scientist you wanted to be because of that?
No. There's also
really?
No choice in my profession. No. The joke is that the joke I hear is that Bill Prady, our creator, executive producer, figured we might as well make her what Mayim is, so Mayim can fix things if they're wrong.
But what's interesting is that you, as a female scientist, are playing on an even field with Sheldon Cooper. Right?
Well, I mean, I think that the most disturbing thing about their relationship, at least to Sheldon, is that she's not a physicist. But he has a tremendous respect and affection for her mental capacities and her, you know, her general intellect, which I also think, you know, when challenged by feminists, I actually think that's a beautiful aspect of how they're portraying these characters. It's never, ever been brought up at all, really, what Amy looks mm-hmm. like, or is he attracted to her? He's attracted right. to her because she's brilliant, and that's enough for him, despite the fact that she's not a physicist, which I think is very sweet.
It is interesting. Let's go to the phones to Stephanie in Daytona Beach. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there.
Hi there. Go ahead.
First, I want to say I'm really excited. Mr. Plato, I love your program. And, Maya, I think that you are the most amazing character on Big Bang, so thank you so much. I was curious, the work that you do as a character, Amy Farrah Fowler, when she's in her lab, is that realistic? Is that similar to what you would be doing as a scientist in a real life lab?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. The short answer is yes. I do have a part in sometimes helping design what kind of things we'd be doing in the lab. It doesn't exactly look like what our lab would look like, especially with dissection stuff.
Right.
But there's also, you know, if you think about it hard enough, the kind of work she has mentioned she does varies widely. So I like to imagine that she's part of some larger lab and does a lot of different collaborations or maybe co-authors projects. But yes, we use accurate tools that I would do dissections with. When we needed a tumor to be dissected, I was able to explain kind of the dimensions. And, you know, sometimes I change some of the adjectives if we need to describe tumors. And also in terms of brain regions, I try and make sure that that's accurate. You know, if they're talking about emotion, that we're talking about, you know, the amygdala or the basal ganglia and not about, you know, somatosensory cortex or something.
All right.
Well, yes, thank you so much. And I think that you deserve many more tiaras. That was the funniest episode ever.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Tina in St. Paul. Hi, Tina.
Hi.
Hi there.
We're huge fans of the show, total fans. And I just have an observation. I'm wondering, I've always had very geek interests. And, you know, did that push my kids, who are also involved in physics and pursuing advanced degrees in physics, or would they have found kind of geekiness on their own, you know, through their schoolmates and through the educational system?
I assume you're asking me, you know, as a neuroscientist, you know, there's a tremendous amount of genetic propensity, not necessarily for what TV shows you like, but for literally how you view the world, how you react to things, how things touch you, and how things move you. So that's that part of it, but absolutely, you know, raising a child in a geek-friendly atmosphere, which is what my two sons, you know, they're destined for geekiness. There's no way out of that one. That absolutely will have an influence as well, but I think you really do need to have kind of a template for that kind of world to then make sense to you.
How do you...
It's kind of funny, because there's no question my son was interested in the comic books, the Warhammer figures, the
yep.
whole bit.
That's
you know,
all your fault. He'll be in therapy talking about it. It's all your fault.
How are you
yeah,
so
well,
sure, Maya, that
show.
Your kids...
We just absolutely
Thank you.
Love it.
Thanks
Thank
for calling.
You.
How are you so sure that your kids are going to follow the way you want them to with all the geeky...
I don't even know if it's the way that I want them. I mean, the fact is my husband, you know, my in-laws are Trekkies, and my husband also comes from musical theater background. On my side, obviously, I have a strong creative side, but also a really, really analytical, mm-hmm. you know, philosophical side. So I like to say our kids just have a double dose of geek, so it's statistically going to happen. But no, I think it depends. I don't know that I need them to go that way, but it's not a surprise to us that they already love comic books. They love the bigger issues of superheroes. It's not
right.
just the punching that they like. They like the concepts of good and evil. They like elaborate, you know, battles. They like those kinds of things because, you know, again, strongly genetically inclined.
Mm-hmm. In the storyline on The Big Bang Theory, how important is it to get some real science into the show, or is that just sort of a peripheral thing?
You know, it's more a decision for our writers and producers, you know, in terms of what they need to move along in the plot and how. And, you know, thank God my job is to take the script and make it funny and not have to create it because that's not my skill. But I think in terms of how accurate we want it, that's super important. It's very important to our writers and producers. Many of them are scientifically inclined. Many of them have backgrounds in sort of science tech stuff, and I would say it's extremely important to us, and that's part of the fun of our show, I think, is the accuracy. Dr. David Salzberg is our physics consultant from UCLA. We do work hard on that stuff to make it accurate. It's important.
Yeah, and so all those equations we see on the blackboards in the living room, they all make sense.
Yeah, all the posters on the walls of, you know, my lab and stuff like that, they're actually pulled from neurobiology labs at UCLA. So, yeah, that stuff really matters to us.
Let's go to the phones. Amy in Springfield, Mass. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I want to say thank you for being someone who's in the public eye, who's willing to speak out about attachment parenting, about being present with your children, about sleeping with your children. I have 6 kids. I work in a place called Cradle that's all about supporting moms and parents, and I want to thank you so much for sharing that with people who wouldn't otherwise get access to it.
Thank you.
And
I want to thank you. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I also want to thank you for your willingness to come, and mine's coming to speak to our school in West Hartford. And something that hasn't been brought up and maybe you don't talk about a lot is just we're grateful that to see someone who is an Orthodox Jew who's able to maintain that presence and dress appropriately as one would on a national television show. And I want to thank you for being able to do that and role modeling that for young women, both as a
thank
parent
you. I mean,
and as a neuroscientist.
No, I appreciate it sincerely. I will say that, you know, the decision for them to dress Amy Frumpy has nothing to do, you know, with any levels of Jewish or religious modesty. But I think it's been really nice that that we've had a consistent look for Amy that absolutely, you know, is in some ways consistent with how I tend to dress. But there's nothing about, you know, any dress codes that say that you have to be frumpy. But yes, Amy happens to be a frumpy version of me, I guess.
All right. Thank you, Amy, on phone for joining us this hour. We're talking with Mayim Bialik. Now, I understand, and you know, when we put up on Facebook on our website that you were coming on, we had a slew of comments about a debate going on there, and I want to just try to boil them all down into one little question.
Right.
And I know what you know what the question is going to be about, I'm sure.
I've got about 7 choices, but go ahead, lay it on me.
No, it's the fact that you have not vaccinated your kids. And
I rarely talk about that. That's so funny.
Well, people were very eager to talk about it because you're in agreement with the American Academy of Pediatricians on their stance on breastfeeding,
sure.
as you point out in your book, but the group also strongly recommends vaccinations for kids.
Sure, and also I should say that attachment parenting, as defined by Dr. William Sears and Attachment Parenting International, has absolutely no opinion on vaccines. It's a completely separate issue, one that I do not discuss in the book for that reason.
Right.
And what I do mention in the book is I give some resources for kind of a pros and cons kinds of books. Dr. Lauren Fader wrote a fantastic small book. What I do say is that we researched every single vaccine, and we spoke about each individual vaccine with our pediatrician, and we went to the CDC sources. The number of vaccines that you and I received when we were kids is a third or a fourth less than what kids get now. So my feeling is you can really do whatever you want, just like I get to do whatever I want, but I don't inherently think that no one should get the flu, for example. And that's
you mean the
my
vaccine.
Personal opinion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Meaning, it to me, the things that people choose to vaccinate against are not necessarily things that were vaccinated against 20, 30 years ago. My feeling is everyone gets to decide and do research based on their family and their needs as to what they want to do, but it's completely separate from attachment parenting or from my book.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's get a couple of more calls here from Andy in Washington. Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was calling because I have a son that headed off to get his PhD from Caltech, and I had heard that the show, at least in part, is based on students from that school, and that would make mm-hmm. sense if it's true because my son's a little bit like Sheldon. I was just curious if that's true.
Yeah, that is where our show takes place. Our show takes place in Pasadena. That's where we gravitate. The Cheesecake Factory we go to on the show is supposed to be the one in Pasadena. Yeah, it's a Pasadena-centric show, and we talk frequently, you know, about Caltech and stuff like that. But I don't think it's where you have to send people if they're like Sheldon Cooper, just so you know.
Is there a local tour of the places that the cast, you know, cast goes to on the show?
Not to my knowledge. That's actually a great question. Not to my knowledge.
You know, like Seinfeld had that tour of where in New York, where to see where Kramer and everybody went. Is there anything like that in Pasadena?
That's hysterical. Not that I know of, but that's actually a really cute idea, and we can talk about it off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. 1-800-99-8255. Is there something you'd like to do on the show? Do you get a chance to develop your character in a way that you haven't been doing yet?
I don't know. I'm super grateful to be an employed actor. I'm super grateful to be at a stage of my career where I have two sweet kids waiting for me at home, and whatever happens at work, I get to leave at work and do with my kids every afternoon and evening. I don't know. I mean, I'm curious if they're going to do kind of an ugly duckling reveal for my character. But honestly, I'm really grateful for whatever they throw at me. I love working with Jim Parsons in particular. I love, you know, the sort of dance that we're doing with our relationship. But no, I think other kind of theatrical aspirations may occur outside of Big Bang Theory. I don't know.
Is it surprising to you how popular the show is? I mean, about a bunch of geeky physicists and now you in there, that the people, it's like one of the highest rated shows on television.
It is. We are, I think, the top rated sitcom. I don't know. I've always thought the geeky world that I revolved in was fascinating. And I guess I hope that people are, you know, laughing with us and not at us. But as I said, our show is not a group of attractive people and the various permutations of hookups that they can, you know, have in a 5-year period. It's really a show about kind of normal people. And, you know, I think some people may enjoy watching because they're more abnormal than the viewers. But I also think a lot of people really resonate with a lifestyle that's not entirely around who can you date, and you know, what kind of materialistic successes can you have. But sometimes you just want to build a Lego Death Star.
Yeah. Talking with Mayim Bialik on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's go with some more folks want to talk to you about the Big Bang Theory. So let's go to the phones. Go to Christine in Boulder. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Hi, Amy. Hi, Ira. I love the show. I think it's so awesome. I am in Boulder, so I'm around all these geeky scientists. I'm married to a scientist. I have never seen Star Wars, Star Trek, any of those shows. And when the Big Bang Theory came on, I thought, oh, no, not another one. But I'm hooked on it. I identify with Penny. These guys are really like this in true life, and the women scientists, too. But I had thought it was so funny when Penny ends up referencing, like, Star Wars or Star Trek or something, and she's, like, so shocked. I found myself doing the same thing. I've never seen those shows. But it's just by association.
Yes, we're insidious, that's for sure.
Did you have to...
I love it.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Mayim, did you have to research all these things? You didn't, you know, the comic books and the references?
The only thing I had to research was, what's the Big Bang Theory?
You had no idea.
I had never seen the show. I was probably too busy just being a general geek. No, I was raised on comic books, and I love science fiction. I got into kind of more graphic novels and stuff as I got older. But no, I had never seen The Big Bang Theory. I go to movies about comic book people. You know, I'm like an X-Men kind of person, and I don't know. That's much more my world than the popular culture world.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, Jim Parsons, he likes to joke, not only am I the only person who knows what all of the characters are saying in the script, I'm the only person who actually cares about, like, the comic book store set. I spend my time in there hanging out.
Any thoughts about when your kids are older that you might go back to being a real life geek again as a scientist?
I teach neuroscience. I teach in our homeschool community. I've been teaching neuroscience since I got my degree. So our boys get a good dose of that and see that I'm still an active scientist. I'm the spokesperson for Texas Instruments, the graphing calculator and scientific calculator people. So we've already started our boys with the new Inspire. We like to show them a lifestyle of science and math, and it's actually been really fun that, like, with TI, I get to have access to all the pH probes and temperature probes that can hook up to this calculator. We've started our boys as soon as possible.
Do you think that's a good thing for parents to try to, kids are natural scientists. They start out wanting to know how everything works, but they can't keep them motivated.
Sure. I think that's one aspect. I think, sociologically, it's also important, especially in communities that don't have funding and where kids can't imagine what it looks like to be a scientist. That's part of why I wanted to do this with TI, to be able to show kids as young as possible, these are the kinds of things scientists do, and you can do it. You can do it too. I think it's tremendously important.
Yeah. Do you think we should ask any of our candidates for the president some science geeky questions, see how they do?
I would watch that, yes.
Well, tell us something about what they know. Okay, thank you very much, Mayim, for taking time to be with us. And good luck to you, and we'll keep watching the show. And who knows, maybe we can make another appearance sometime. Thanks again.
Thank you. This was a real honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Mayim Bialik, actor, also author of the new book, Beyond the Sling, A Real-Life Guide to Raising Confident, Loving Children, The Attachment Parenting Way. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to start talking about climate change. A new study showing that the public, no matter what party you like, Republican, Democrat, whatever, what strain of party is your favorite, you want something done about climate change. Crosses all party lines. We'll be back with the new study showing that. So stay with us after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. If you pay attention to the rhetoric between climate change supporters and deniers, you would think that it is a polarizing issue that you could predict by political party affiliation which way people might fall on issues like clean energy, on taxes on energy. Well, there's a really interesting new poll out this week that says that's not true. A majority of people of all parties believe that global warming should be a political priority, and they want their elected officials to do something about it. Joining me now to talk about it is Anthony Leiserwitz. He's director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication at Yale University in New Haven. He's one of the people behind that survey. Welcome back to the program, Anthony.
It's great to be with you, Ira. Thank you.
I'm just looking at the abstract of your studies, and some of these numbers are amazing. 72% of all Americans think that global warming should be a very high or medium or priority for the president and the Congress. And that crosses all party lines.
It does. It includes 84% of Democrats, 68% of independents, and 52% of Republicans. So, yes, there is this difference between Democrats and Republicans, but nonetheless, a majority of Republicans do think that global warming should be a priority for our elected officials.
So why are we all under the impression that there isn't not this majority?
Great question. So one of the things that became very clear to us early in our research was that Americans don't speak with a single voice on this issue. And in fact, what we've identified is what we call global warming six Americas. That essentially you can look at the country and find that there are six very different communities within the United States that each respond to this issue in very different ways. One group we call the alarmed. That's only about 12% of the public. These are people who are firmly convinced it's happening, human-caused, urgent. They're taking some action in their lives, and they want to know what else can I do as an individual or we do collectively as a society. That's followed by a group we call the concerned. That's about 27%. These are people who also think it's happening in human cause, but they think it's more of a distant threat. You know, maybe distant, impacts won't be felt for a generation or more. So they think we should do something, but it's not a high priority. Then a group we call the cautious. About a quarter of the public. These are kind of fence sitters, still making up their mind, is it happening or not, is it human and natural, et cetera. A group that's about 10% that we call the disengaged, and these are people who say, I've heard of global warming before, but I really don't know anything about it. A group we call the doubtful, that's about 15%. These are people who say, I don't think it's happening, but if it is, it's probably just natural cycles, nothing we've had anything to do with, nothing we can do anything about. So I don't really pay that much attention to it, but I don't think of it much of as a problem. And then last but not least is a group we call the dismissive, and that's about 10% of the public. These are people who are firmly convinced it's not happening, not human-caused, and many of them are what we would lovingly call conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax, it's scientists making up data, it's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty, it's Al Gore and his friends trying to get rich, and many other such variants of those kind of arguments. And so the important thing here is, one, that there are all these different audiences within the American public, each of which responding to this issue in a very different way, coming at it from a very different perspective, but also that the dismissive, those that really are, and they're quite vocal, actually. They're very immobilized. They're very engaged. Given the opportunity, they will talk a lot about this issue. They're only 10%, and yet they appear much larger because they tend to dominate many of, much of the public square, essentially.
And so they're getting the attention maybe because of our media being so polarized also.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, there's a basic imperative, especially in commercial media, to that controversy sells.
Yeah.
And so especially in the 24/7 cable environment where you're desperate for eyeballs, which would you rather see? Somebody who's methodically and deliberately laying out the science of climate change or two people yelling at each other and getting into a fight? So, unfortunately, the media itself has some structural issues that make it harder to have a reasonable conversation.
So, what does the public want their elected officials and their corporations to do?
Well, what we see, interestingly, across the board is that Americans want a whole variety of actors, including corporations in particular, but the government officials, and notably themselves, other citizens, to begin to take actions on this issue. And again, this is across political lines, though, again, there are differences. Republicans not quite as involved and engaged as Democrats, but nonetheless still majorities in most cases. And in a few cases, we see some really interesting things where, for instance, back to that Six Americas idea again, whereas the alarmed and the concerned really support things like regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant, the dismissive tend to be very opposed to that because the dismissive turn out to be pretty against any kind of government interference or intervention in markets or in society. And that's really what many of them fear. They'll complain about climate change and they'll argue about the science, but what really seems to motivate many of them is this underlying fear. They perceive risk, not of climate change, but that government is going to have to play a bigger role in shaping our society. And that, to them, is anathema. That's something they're deeply concerned about. And as a result, they oppose things like that. But when you look at a policy like, should the nation make a major investment in clean energy, everybody supports that. I mean, in some cases, we found 9 out of 10 Americans support a national investment in clean energy. And the point here is that there are many roads to Damascus. People can come to support the exact same policy, albeit for very different reasons. The alarmed and the concerned, they support clean energy because they're worried about carbon emissions and, reducing climate change. But the doubtful and dismissive don't believe in climate change. But they support those exact same policies because they resonate with their deeply held values and concerns, namely that we are so dependent on fossil fuels and other countries for the energy that runs most of our modern society. So this issues of dependence and self-reliance, which are core American values and are really held strongly by these groups, also come into play when we talk about renewable energy.
Are they willing to pay more in taxes?
They are willing to pay more, not necessarily in taxes. That word in particular has come to have all these additional meanings on them, where people have these knee-jerk reactions to the term taxes. But on the other hand, people are much more willing, for instance, to say, look, I'd pay a little bit more for my electricity if it came from clean energy sources. We've asked that, would you pay more for a 20% requirement that all electricity in the country be produced by renewable energy sources, even if it costs the average household $100? And we find that there's very strong support for that, again, across party lines. So it's not that people aren't willing to pay something, and in fact, I would suggest that most people would like to do what they think is as the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, we just generally don't make it easy for them.
Yeah. You say that by a margin of 3-1, Americans say they would be more likely to vote for a political candidate who supports a, quote, revenue-neutral tax shift. What does that mean?
Yeah, really interesting. So we all remember now that there was this big fight in this country over cap and trade, you know, this market mechanism that was put forward a couple years ago, which did not pass. At the same time, there's been a whole other community of scholars that have looked and been proposing a different approach, which is basically that you increase taxes on something that we think is, in this case, is a bad, fossil fuel use, and decrease an equivalent amount of taxes on something that we all think of as good, which is income taxes. And so this is often called a tax swap, that basically we don't let the elected officials, we don't give Congress a cent more, but that we increase taxes on fossil fuels and decrease taxes on people's income tax by an equivalent amount. And what's interesting about that is who supports that. We see everyone from Al Gore on the one hand to very conservative former representative Bob Inglis on the other, liberal institutions like Brookings Institute to the very conservative American Enterprise Institute support this exact same idea. And what we again find is that, as you just said, 3-1 Americans support that, including Republicans, 2-1 say that they would be more likely to vote for a candidate who supports that kind of a policy.
Well, do you then think that this will be raised? Are these issues of Americans wanting some action, they want some more renewable energies, can this be an issue in the election year this year?
Wonderful question. We don't really know. I wish I had a crystal ball for this year, but I don't. And what we have seen, however, is that, for instance, President Obama about a week ago, gave an interview in Rolling Stone where he said that he was planning to make climate change an issue in this campaign. We'll see how it plays out. Clearly, climate change does not rise to the level of national priority for most Americans as the economy and unemployment and, you know, other kinds of issues like that. I mean, that's perfectly understandable. But nonetheless, because the parties have seemingly drifted apart so far in terms of their views of climate change and climate change science, that perhaps there's going to be a robust discussion about which of these two approaches do people prefer.
You know, as this horse race gets going down the stretch here this year, we're going to be seeing polls come out virtually every week, right?
Yeah.
But I'm asking you, how many of them are going to ask any of these questions you've asked about, you know, climate change, global warming, alternative energies? It seems like when you look at the polling, the exit polling, whatever, that the pollsters ask, they hardly ever ask these kinds of questions in those polls.
That's generally true. I mean, not completely true. I mean, Gallup does ask questions about this on a regular basis. Pew asks questions about this on a regular basis and a number of other places. But you're right. I mean, look, pollsters generally are following very closely what's currently in the news, and so the media plays a huge role here in setting the agenda. What are the issues that we're going to argue about in this election? Well, we don't know, in part because we don't yet know not only how the media is going to report it, but what are the issues that are going to be happening, the events that are happening at the moment? You know, is unemployment up or is unemployment down? You know, does Israel attack Iran or not? If they do, or we, you know, go into that kind of a confrontational stance, you know, nobody's going to be talking about climate change in that kind of a situation. So that's why no one can look ahead, months ahead, and say, yeah, this will be the issue that's going to be, you know, top on most people's minds when they're going into the voting booth.
But shouldn't you at least offer the people you're polling the option of checking that box as one of the issues?
In terms of,
you know, as climate change or renewable energy, things like that, if the choice is not even offered on the sheet of things that is on your radar screen.
Yeah. Well, I this is actually a really important point, is that when you look at, and I'll just come back to media coverage as an example, you know, for most people, this is an issue that's invisible. I mean, you can look out your window right this moment, and there's CO2 pouring out of tailpipes, out of smokestacks, out of buildings, but you can't see it. And likewise, you can't see the impacts unless you know where to look. In fact, the only way most Americans even know about this issue is because of what they've learned about it through the media. They're not reading the peer-reviewed literature. They don't know scientists personally. They're learning about it through the media. And when the media doesn't report this issue, it's literally out of sight and out of mind.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between the national poll you conducted and registered voters? Did they have different opinions about it?
No, in fact, that's exactly what we did in this study, is that we asked people, are you registered to vote? And we only looked at those Democrats, Republicans, and Independents who are registered, because obviously those are the people who will actually walk into the voting booth.
Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of people exactly who the politicians want to know about, the registered voters.
Absolutely.
And have you gotten any reaction from them at all?
I think there's a lot of interest. And, I mean, in fact, as I look back at the bigger picture, we've kind of gone through this, I don't know if it's a cycle, but it's certainly a set of shifts, where everybody was talking about climate change and sustainability and global environmental problems, if you'll remember, back in 2007 and 2008. And then suddenly everybody stopped talking about it. And, in fact, for many people, the term, using the word global warming or climate change in political discourse, was seen as something you shouldn't do. I think what we may be at the beginning of is to be able to bring these words back into our political discourse, and actually as a point of discussion about how do we move forward as a society.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Anthony Leiserwitz, he's the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication at Yale. How can you follow up with this? Can you keep coming up with new polls so we can follow this?
Oh, absolutely. We'll be doing this at least twice a year. And, of course, we have lots of other colleagues around the country that are also surveying on these exact same topics.
And how will we know if this does move more into the political discourse as well as the public discourse?
Well, I think we'll see it. I mean, first of all, you can see it in the number of times that the president talks about this, that candidate Mitt Romney talks about this, as well as across the board. I mean, remember, it's not just a presidential election. Mm-hmm. There are Senate races and congressional races all over this country. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people are beginning to ask the question about climate change. And let me add this, because this same study also found that many Americans are beginning to talk about or think about in their own mind, or more importantly, connect the dots between climate change and this incredible spate of extreme weather that we've experienced over the past year and a half. I mean, last year, 2011, we had over $14 billion disasters. Okay, it was an all-time record in the United States. And in this survey, we actually asked people, did you actually experience one of these extreme weather events or disasters? 8 out of 10 Americans say yes. Were you harmed by these events? 1/3 of Americans say that, yes, they were harmed a substantial amount by one of these events. And then last, how are you interpreting these events? Do you think that global warming made any of these events worse? And what we find is large majorities of Americans are already beginning to say yes to that question. 72% of Americans, for instance, think that global warming made the record warm winter we've just experienced, and in some places still experiencing, worse. Likewise, the record summer temperatures we saw last year, or the drought in Texas and Oklahoma. 69% of Americans think that climate change played at least some role in that. So what it does is it begins to open up this conversation where we're no longer talking about global climate change exclusively, but also about what does that mean for us locally, where we live.
And that goes to what you were saying before. No one can see carbon dioxide, but they can see the storms.
That's
they
right.
can't see the hurricanes,
That's
the
right.
tornadoes and things, and try to connect the dots themselves if no one else is going to connect the dots for them.
That's exactly right.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Iris. Great to be with you.
And I look forward to your next poll. Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication at Yale University and one of the people behind this new survey out this week. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Serena-Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo, our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch is our technical director. But at the controls in New York is Manoli Weatherall today. And here in New York, Sean Phillips is spinning the dials for us behind the glass. If you missed any part of the program or others, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. And we want to remind you that our iPhone app is produced by Pastime Software. And you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and take it along with you. Right with our, we have our Android and iPhone apps. And soon to have a new website look. So get ready for that. We'll be looking forward to introducing it to you very soon. I'm Ira Flatow. Have a great weekend.